This episode of the Nighttime Podcast is a direct continuation of an ongoing series covering the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. If you haven't already listened to the prior episodes on the series, I suggest you back up and start at the beginning. My prior episodes on this case, as well as many others, are available on iTunes or on my website, nighttimepodcast.com.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome to part 3 of the Nighttime Podcast's coverage of the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. In the prior episode of this series, our guest Fons Jessam walked us through the trio's getaway gone wrong from the scene of their robbery gone wrong. We discussed a set of false arrests, and how after the high-profile release of these men, the local police regrouped and managed to connect the faint dots linking Derek Wood, Freeman McNeil, and Darren Muse. Once this connection was made, the use of polygraph testing quickly led to the arrest of the three men responsible for the senseless crime. In tonight's episode, we'll conclude the telling of this story again with our guest, Fons Jessam. As part 2 concluded, Fons Jessam walked us through the various confessions made by Derek, Freeman, and Darren. Although all three men admitted to playing a role in this crime, they certainly weren't telling interrogators the same story. Darren and Freeman minimized their role, while Derek seemed to only remember what he was responsible for. Despite the group pointing fingers at each other, police had more than enough to press charges. The decision was made to have all three men tried separately. The first to face justice was Derek Wood. He's the McDonald's employee who is said to have masterminded this crime. Derek was also the one responsible for firing the first shot in the basement of the restaurant. Fons will describe Derek's trial and the result now.
Derek was up first, and it was like no trial I had ever covered, and I'd covered easily a dozen murder trials in that courthouse by then. Threats had been made that they were going to be shot, they were never going to get to trial. Friends of some of the families had made threats. So security in the courthouse was extreme. The emotion in the building was tangible. You couldn't help but feel it when you walked in because of the presence of the families, and it was going to be their second opportunity to see Derek Wood, but their first opportunity to see justice. A lot of money was spent on this prosecution to make sure that the prosecuting attorneys had every weapon possible to get through these trials. And they're to be credited as well. I mean, Ken Haley, Brian Willison, and Mark Chisholm, they spent a year doing nothing but work these cases. The two top lawyers from the Legal Aid Office in Sydney were representing Derek. Each lawyer was going to try and get, for whatever reason he could, the confessions thrown out, because if they can get the confession thrown out, any evidence gathered after that confession as a result of that confession is fruit of the poison tree. It can't be introduced. So the prosecutors knew that was going to be the big fight, but they also had to build as much evidence just in case they lost those. So getting back to the confession he finally did make, he had asked to see, he said, "I think I want to talk to my lawyer." And this was after he'd been in custody for a very long time and they were getting close. And the officer said, "Are you sure you're going to be able to get him?" And he said, "What time is it?" And he said, 5 o'clock in the morning. And then he continued the conversation. So the question was going to be, was he denied counsel? The argument for the Crown was going to be a week earlier, he had met with his counsel twice. He had met with his counsel early that night. This was like 12 hours later, but he did meet with him early that night when he was in custody. That was sort of the tilting point in his trial. That was what had the family sick leading up, you know, during the first early days as these arguments in voir dire before the jury was ever present. And this was something that enraged Neil Burrow's brothers. They were infuriated. They didn't understand it. This guy confessed to killing these people. Why are these silly rules being brought in now? They just couldn't follow what was happening, which is typical of families drawn into this horrific thing we call a justice system. I wish somebody would change the name, because really It's built to make sure an innocent man doesn't go to jail. That's the sole focus. It's not about justice. It's about finding facts, not truth. Truth is facts and taken in proper context. The justice system looks at the facts only and ignores context. And families of murder victims find that out very painfully, very quickly, that it's not about their dead child or their dead husband or dead wife. It's about the person sitting there with the sheriffs. It's making sure that he or she is not an innocent man or woman going to jail. And this was killing the families of the McDonald's victims. They just couldn't handle it. The McDonald's families are the reason the Victim Services Office exists in Nova Scotia, because they were thrown into this thing without any real support or without anyone other than me or any other journalist. It turned out they chose me, probably because TV was, I was in their living room every day. You get that sense, people think they know you because you're so familiar. So I became their source of explanation during the breaks, during the lunches. They still all would not go on camera. All of the families had agreed when they made the agreement with the police and the prosecutors that they would not go on camera because what they say could cause the trial to go off. It caused a mistrial. The big hurdle again in that first one was the day that the judge said, yes, we're going to have this confession as part of our evidence. Live with it. So they were all celebrating that and asking me what that would mean, but still not talking about it on camera. But then the real trial began. The jury was there, and Derek Wood was presenting himself in the way that he and his lawyers wanted him to be presented in front of the jury, which was with his head down, his hands clasped, very sorrowful, very quiet. And he was a quiet, shy guy, so it wasn't hard for him to pull that off. He didn't interact with his counsel much. And it's my habit in trial to watch the accused to try and find a tidbit to report on something, some reaction, a tear, a giggle, anything that I could report on. And what I found in Derek during that first trial was when the jury and judge were present, the shy, introverted, sorrowful young man was there. When they were out of the room during breaks, he would laugh and joke with his lawyers, and it infuriated my cameraman at the time, Gary Mansfield, because he was seeing both sides of Derek, but he was only able to capture sorrowful Derek. When he got out of the truck to enter the courthouse, handcuffed, head down, very sorrowful look. When he'd catch him walking in and out in the hallway, head down, very sorrowful look. But he wanted that laughing Derek shot. And one day he got it. It's one of the funnier moments between he and I during the trial. He wanted to hide behind me. We called Gary Moose. He was a very, very big boy, a weightlifter, 6'2", 6'3", carrying 260 very well. I'm 150 maybe, 5'9", and he wanted to hide behind me with a beta cam on his shoulder. Like, it was not going to happen, right? So what he did was he just figured out a way to ambush Derek. When the judge and jury were out, he was allowed to shoot through the doorway. So he hid and waited until he had me there to say, yeah, he's laughing. And he just jumped into the doorway and got the shot. And you could see the moment. And he used that repeatedly in his reporting to show the difference, where he's laughing, looks up, sees the camera, and faded into sorrowful, head down, hands crossed, Derek. So that was a moment that the families really appreciated seeing on TV. But it gave the audience, the viewers, their first chance to see that this guy we've been seeing every night, who looks so sorry, maybe not so sorry. And then as the evidence began to come out and the horrific, horrific tape, that crime scene tape that I'll never forget, that still had Neil Burrows and Donna Warren in it, that was played and that I had to report on and describe, they then could put him in context of that because they saw the smile, they saw the laugh under these circumstances, and that the immediate false reaction when he saw the camera. So that was a moment that helped us get that little kernel of truth out. And it almost felt at that point in the coverage that things were beginning to shift. Because there was a lot of concern among the families, the Burroughs family in particular, about the argument being presented and the questions being asked by Art Mullen, the defense attorney, about timing. they were presenting the argument that it wasn't possible for Derek to be inside the restaurant because he couldn't get to King's Convenience by 1:15. So they were arguing there's no way he could have been inside the restaurant and been there in time to call. So that was scaring the Burroughs family. They were also the reason that tape that I mentioned a moment ago was played. They wanted the jury to see all of that blood. And there was a lot, of, in particular around Neil Burroughs, but also Donna Warren in the office, there was a lot of blood. And Jimmy Fagan, where he went down, there was a lot of blood. Where Arlene went down, the straws and everything on the floor were covered in blood. And they wanted the jury to understand that this young man was in police custody that night and there was no blood on his clothes and no blood on his shoes. How could he possibly have been in there? That was their defense. It wasn't him. That he just held the door open and ran. And the families were really worried. And the jury went out for a long time on that one. And when that verdict came in, it was like an electric wire flowing, you know, electric current flowing through that courtroom. The relief, the tears, the moaning, the crying of the families, the celebration. One of the brothers, Neil Burroughs' brother, ran outside to finally see him being led into the van as a guilty man and to threaten him openly and screaming, and we captured that. And I think that was the day my relationship with the families was ultimately cemented. By then, I had gradually befriended all of them, even Arlene McNeil herself, who arrived. I was able to chat with her. She was in a wheelchair, of course, but and her mother and I had grown close. But two of the mothers pushed my microphone away when I came in and just hugged me and cried. They drew me. That had never happened to me before in covering a trial. I'd developed relationships, close relationships with families, and I've had people cry and reach out to me, but not embrace me and thank me. There was nothing to thank me for. I'd simply answered their questions. But I realized at that point that they were taking me to a place that I didn't want to go as a journalist because there were two more trials to cover and that I would have to be careful about my relationship. And it took the wind out of me. But we did manage to regroup and grab the microphone and get a clip from every family, you know, which was the ultimate victory for me. From nobody speaking to on the day of the verdict, everybody spoke. But the prosecutors spoke quickly and then had to go to their office and they were crying. This was such an emotional ordeal. And they had so much of themselves invested in it that they had to leave. And they couldn't handle the emotion that was being expressed in the hallway by these families. They just couldn't handle it being present. They were crying. So they had to leave. It was pretty intense.
With Derek being found guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder, 1 attempted murder, forcible confinement, and armed robbery, he'd receive a life sentence. For my listeners abroad, here in Canada, that equates to 25 years. Shortly after Derek's trial, Darren Muse would next face the courts. Fons was also there to experience the Muse trial firsthand.
The big difference in the Darren Muse trial was Darren Muse. There was no head down, quiet, you know, guy. There was a cocky, arrogant, self-important, extremely confident guy who swaggered in and out of the courtroom. Neil Burroughs' brothers wanted a piece of that guy so badly, I wasn't sure they weren't going to try and get it. The RCMP believed they were going to try and get it because he was all about him. And why wouldn't he be? He had, you know, he had a deal on the table that nobody knew about. At the very beginning of the trials, the families were promised, and I was there at the time, by the head prosecutor who went on to become a judge, so it wasn't his promise to carry out, that there would be no deals. But in the case of Darren, they were concerned about a police officer who had become angry with him and spoke to him aggressively. And the judge hearing the case, and there was going to be a voir dire over the admissibility again, it was all about the confession because there was no physical evidence. So the RCMP were genuinely concerned that this judge was only going to listen to the questioning. It was his habit not to listen to the answers, not to hear the voice of the accused, because in voir dire, the argument over the admissibility of a confession is not about what's in the confession. It's about the behavior of the police officers who gathered that confession. And this judge was one of Nova Scotia's judges. There were several, who were in the habit of, I only want to hear what the police had to say. And without hearing the arrogant, cocky, confident responses from Muse, to hear this police officer yelling at him and telling him he hated him and didn't believe him and he was a liar and no good, venting his frustration, and this was a big police officer, physically large. Darren Muse was not. He wasn't small, but he wasn't big. He wasn't Freeman McNeil. So the RCMP were really worried that if this judge chose to only hear the questions, he'd get to that point and say, no, that's intimidation. I don't want to hear any more. Anything said after this point in the interrogation is inadmissible. Mm-hmm. There was a real chance. It might not have happened. We'll never know. Because his lawyer had convinced Darren that it was in his best interest to plead down. Second degree, try and make a deal, try and get out, you know, because second degree murder, of course, you can get out in as little as 10 years, as much as 25. It's all about the parole then. First degree murder, automatic parole to 25. So there's 15 years on the table between a first degree conviction and a second degree plea. But the RCMP held a meeting in the courthouse early in the process of the trial during the voir dire and begged the families. The families knew the offer was on the table, but the prosecutors said no. They were sticking with the prosecution office promise, no deals. Mm-hmm. They wanted first degree. So the RCMP, the leaders of the investigation and some senior officers called all the families into a separate courtroom adjacent at the end of the day and explained their worry and explained what second degree murder would be and that they would definitely get him in jail and that they could trust the prosecutors to argue for the maximum. So not all of the family members agreed, but ultimately a vote was taken and most of the family members agreed. So the next day, when they were about to begin, Joel Pink, who was the lawyer who was representing Darren Muse, said, Your Honor, would you read the charges again? And the judge immediately recognized what was happening here. So he said, Mr. Muse, stand up. You do understand that anything you've been told, anything you may or may not have been promised, does not involve me. I am not bound to any deal. But of course, Joel Pink prepared him for that. And he said, yes, sir. He said, you know, how do you plead to the first degree murder? And he not guilty to the included charge of second degree murder, guilty. So he pled guilty to second degree murder in the case of Neil Burrows, not guilty to Jimmy Fagan, where he was also charged with first degree murder for handing the gun to Freeman. But the only way they were going to be able to prove that would be if Freeman testified and he wasn't going to. So they got him on robbery. They got him on unlawful confinement of Donna Warren downstairs and on second degree murder. So then it became his trial became all about the vagaries of the justice system, first and second degree, how much time. Ultimately, the prosecution service did a brilliant job. If you were there, you could have believed 12 to 15 years was likely because Joel Pink brought a lot of precedent evidence of cases that seemed more brutal, where that was the range of parole eligibility. Only one Canadian criminal in history, and he was a recidivist who had committed many crimes, had ever been given the maximum 25. But that's what the prosecution was asking the judge for. In the end, the judge gave him 20, which was very, very, very much on the high side and not what Joel Pink expected, nor what Darren Muse expected. And the families were satisfied with that. They wanted 25, but they by the end of the arguments, they were worried about 12. So 20 felt pretty good.
As you just heard, Darren Muse pled guilty to armed robbery and the second-degree murder of Neil Burrows. For his part in this crime, he would receive a 20-year prison sentence. For any of you doing the math, that made him eligible for parole in 2012, but we'll come back to that shortly. Let's pick up the story with the final trial, that being Freeman McNeil's.
That was a different case entirely because the courts agreed that he couldn't get a fair trial, a jury trial in Sydney. Because after the first trial of Derek Wood, Joel Pink petitioned the court to have his case heard by judge alone because he believed all of the publicity around the Wood case was just too much, and the judge agreed. So the judge ruled that, yes, he would be tried in Halifax. His defense was one of PTSD. They had him interviewed by a psychologist who determined that, remember in his statement, he blacked out. He didn't remember what he really did. and things that had happened afterward. They decided that their best defense was PTSD, which was blown out of the water completely by another forensic psychologist who said it was ridiculous to think that he could possibly have PTSD when the first letter stands for post. You can't get PTSD during an event. It begins to appear much later, three, 6 months down the road or even later than that. So the jury didn't buy any of that. And the emotional explosion that came with the verdict in that trial exceeded the emotion in the Wood trial, surprisingly. And it was a member of Jimmy Fagan's family, his sister, lost control and began to shake and shake and shake and shake. And as he was being led out, she yelled to her brothers to get him, get him, get him. And the police seized her and began to drag her out. And she got into, not the police, pardon me, the sheriff's officers. She got into a fight with them. And she was being dragged out then outside the courtroom where the cameras were. And her fight was because she didn't want to be seen by the cameras. And she had managed to avoid any publicity or any comment. That she was a very conservative woman, as were Jimmy's brothers. Yet she exploded and she became very much a part of the story. And then that spread like fire through the room. And I remember looking at Freeman's mother, who attended all of it. And she was just crushed because the mother of one of the other victims went over and began to scream at her. And the police had to stand in front of her and get her out of there. But it was just a circus. It was crazy, the emotion, because they had been put through hell for 3 years. He got convicted, I'm mistaken. He got a first, but he got a second on Neil Burrows. That was second degree. They determined that the clubbing he gave may not have contributed to the death, and he might not have known. Or the language in the criminal code is you administer force that is likely to cause death and you are reckless as to whether or not death occurs, and that'll get you a second degree. So the jury found him guilty of second degree. It was a pointless, except for precedent, it was pointless, but the jury recommended the full 25. So he's the second Canadian ever to get 25 on a second degree, but he already had the 25 on the first degree of Jimmy Fagan. So it really, there are no consecutive sentences in Canada. As I like to say, the first murder will cost you, the rest are free, because you're never, ever given a consecutive sentence and you don't get any more jail time for anybody you kill after the first. But also in Canada, life sentence is a life. Even when you're released on parole, you're still guilty of murder. And if you do anything, that murder sentence is immediately clamped down and you're put back in jail on the murder. If you violate your parole, you return on your murder sentence, because life is life in Canada.
Just like Derek was before him, Freeman McNeil is convicted of first-degree murder with no chance of parole for 25 years, the maximum sentence Canada has to offer. With Derek Wood, Darren Muse, and Freeman McNeil now behind bars, with the difficult trials behind them, the community surrounding this crime would begin the long process of healing. The first aspect of this we'll consider is the actual restaurant itself. It reopened just as the men were being arrested. I asked Fonz if this crime left a stigma associated with the McDonald's restaurant.
People who followed the story closely away from Cape Breton, to them, the only image of that restaurant was the one surrounded by police cars at night with yellow tape. But the restaurant, I knew Garfield Lewis well. He owned it. It returned to regular sales very quickly. It went back to what it was. It has since been torn down, but not because of this, simply because a larger retail complex was being built down below. It was in a really bad spot to begin with, on a very steep hill. So the new owner tore it down and built a new one down below in the parking lot where the other businesses were. But people went back there and returned to the restaurant. Some early on, no doubt, went there out of some disturbed sense of just wanting to be inside the restaurant where it happened. But that didn't last long, and Garfield told me within a year his sales were back to what they had been prior to. As far as McDonald's corporate, it was very responsible after the murders, brought counselors in, set them up in a hotel in Sydney to deal with all of the workers and their families, did everything it could to help them along, because it had learned in the mass killing in the San Ysidro, California McDonald's that's the way to deal with it. So, and they didn't want it to become something that stigmatized their employees or their restaurant. They certainly didn't cooperate with me. They didn't give interviews. They didn't want to talk about it, but they were very good to their employees and the families of their employees.
Now, considering the broader community itself, Fonz described the events this crime had on our peaceful home and the loss of innocence we suffered.
Nobody who was there then as an adult forgets the Sydney Cape Breton before McDonald's and the Sydney Cape Breton after McDonald's. It was, I hate to be trite or use a cliche in connection to this story, but it was sort of the end of innocence for Cape Breton. This was local grown boys with no trouble with the law prior to this. They were capable of this kind of vicious, horrific violence, and there was nowhere to look but home. It was homegrown. It changed the view a lot of people had of home, but certainly life went on. It changed the prosecution service. It changed policing in Cape Breton. There are lingering effects that are felt today in the way cases are handled. The justice system and both arms, both the investigative arm and the prosecutorial arm, even the defense wing, because it was handled by legal aid, they all grew up. This forced them to a level they never expected to have to work at.
In this final segment of our story, we'll hear the current status of the three men convicted, and Fonz will dispel a commonly discussed rumor. We'll start with that. Prior to this crime, Darren Muse was said to have had an interest in computers and was interested in pursuing education in computer science. During his time in prison, rumors were widely circulated, and still are to this day, that Darren Muse had made a significant amount of money by investing in inheritance in Research in Motion stock. Research in Motion are the makers of the once popular BlackBerry phone. Even on the McDonald's murders Wikipedia entry, there's an entire section dedicated to this rumor. As Darren received only a 20-year sentence, he has been living outside of prison since 2012. Many who believe this rumor think Darren may be living a life of luxury. I asked Fonz for his thoughts on this rumor.
Did he ever say it? Probably. He was very much a braggart and was always talking about the ways he was going to become rich or famous, or he was, if anybody said anything, Darren had to top it and make his experience bigger and better. Everyone I talked to who knew him well said that nobody took him seriously, that he was full of shit. So he loved his family by all indications. They were a close family, and his mom and dad ended up working as apartment building managers at a large apartment complex in Clayton Park. They left Sydney. His dad continued to work as a taxi driver. He's been out on parole now for 5 years. His father has since passed. There's no indication of any wealth reaching his family. No indication that I've heard out of Montreal of him suddenly living, you know, large. I think it's garbage. I think it's just a bullshit rumor started from something he had said. I don't know that, but the evidence to the journalist in me suggests not true.
And now we'll address the most controversial update, and the one that has brought this crime back into the public eye lately. As this crime occurred 24 years ago, and a life sentence in Canada is 25 years, the original sentences are about to expire. I asked Fonz Jessam if and when the trio is expected to gain their freedom. Fonz will start by discussing Darren Muse's prison sentence and release.
Darren Muse worked the prison system perfectly, just as he did the trial system. He went in, he was the model prisoner, he took courses, he upgraded himself, he did everything he was supposed to do. So when he was eligible for day parole, he was the star of the, you know, theory that you can be rehabilitated. Is he? I hope so, you know. He certainly convinced the parole board that he was, and he has done nothing wrong since being released. Freeman McNeil only recently, a matter of weeks ago, was granted escorted passes into the community, which is the first step, because in May, it'll be 25 years and he will be up for full parole. So the process is escorted passes, unescorted passes, a group home, where you're allowed out certain times if you can get a job. So they're easing him into the community now. The families fought that, but He's done nothing wrong in prison to prevent that. They can, if as is the case with Derek Wood, extend if you misbehave in prison, or if they believed he was likely, you know, if he became involved in gang activity. But he didn't. There was no indication he was the model prisoner Darren was, but I think he learned from Darren. And in his last years, started working toward next year. Because remember, these are young men. You know, he's going to be, what, 46 when he gets out? That's not old. You know, it's a heck of an old age to start your life. So, yeah, he's in the process of being paroled out now. Wood will have to wait that extra year because the year was added onto his sentence for something that he did in prison. But there's no reason to believe that in May of next year, 2018, that he won't be released as well.
With that clip behind us, we're now in the present day. Darren Muse is a free man who may or may not be living a life of luxury. Freeman McNeil is making the first steps towards his release, which is likely to occur in 2017. And Derek Wood is also nearing release, in his case, likely occurring in 2018. If you're wondering about the extra year Derek received, it's related to a 1998 event in which he stabbed a fellow inmate with a sharpened toothbrush. Before we conclude this episode, we'll take some time to learn a bit more about our guest, Fonz Jessam. The first thing I'd like to do is have Fonz describe the process of writing his book on this case, the bestseller, Murder at McDonald's. I recommend anyone interested in hearing more of this story to stop what you're doing and go buy the book. It's available as an ebook via Mysterious Press. I'll have a link to it in my episode show notes. Fonz will now describe working on the book I've read likely more than any other, Murder at McDonald's.
There was so much interest in this story, the network wanted a half-hour special. So by then, as I stated, I was living in Halifax, so I went back home and convinced the families to do one more television interview and interviewed Arlene, who was in rehab, and went back to the restaurant and did a walkthrough myself on camera, went to the graveyard with Olive Warm, where she went every single day to Donna's grave, to put together a half-hour documentary that was my final stamp. That documentary aired on a Sunday. On Monday at work, I got a call from a publisher. We want a book. I didn't want to write it. It took a toll on me, I admit that. And I was looking for a gentle way to get out. But the publisher, Dorothy Blythe, at the time did say, well, if you don't, I'll find somebody willing to go into Sydney and just start from the beginning. And that played on me because I knew if I was a reporter sent to Washington, and by then I had traveled a lot and had to undo, sort of find this story in book form, I would have to really be an invasive presence with the families. Not just the police and the court, but the families, because they were the story. But I still gave it a couple of days, and a good friend, Greg Boone, who was my colleague in the newsroom in Sydney, kept pushing that somebody's going to come in here and start knocking over gravestones. He said, I'm not going to write it. You know I'm not going to write it. They're going to get somebody who is going to... So he really pushed hard on what he knew was my guilt. So I finally said, fine, I'll write it. And I told the families I was going to write it. And I said, can we talk one more time? And that'll be the end of it. So I went back and dug deeper and asked more questions. And I had already obtained the tapes from the police and all of the exhibits and the written statements as part of that half-hour documentary. So I had everything, you know. I just had to ask some questions of the families that I hadn't, and to look at it differently as an author would, and to write it. And, you know, interestingly enough, to talk about the way this case was treated here, the publisher released it, but there was no book launch. It was not in the catalog. It was not advertised in any way. It went crazy. It was a multiple times a bestseller. It kept selling out. It sold like hotcakes, literally. I mean, you couldn't keep it in stores. It was crazy the way it sold. Showed the appetite for it, but it was still sort of the ugly stepchild of the publishing house. They never put anything behind it, ever. They didn't, because until then they had never published anything like it, and it didn't fit with their image of themselves. So it succeeded in spite of the publisher who wanted it, not because of the publisher who wanted it. But then, interestingly enough, life being what it is, 23 or 4 years later, it got the attention of Otto Penzler, who is a legend in both true crime and crime fiction circles out of New York. He owns the Mysterious Bookstore in New York, which he claims is the oldest mystery crime-only bookstore in the United States. He's a very big player in the crime fiction and true crime field. He picked it up. I owned all rights to it because it had been out of print for 15 years, and he wanted to make it an ebook. Well, there was no clause in the contract that I signed back in the 90s anyway, because ebooks were a fantasy, weren't they? Mm-hmm. We didn't have an internet, let alone an ebook. Yeah. So he has now put it out through Mysterious Press in New York only weeks ago, and it is beginning to garner interest again all these years later. You're here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about it, and the book is being sold worldwide as an ebook at any place you can get an ebook. It's available on iTunes, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and I checked with the publisher yesterday, and they say it's encouraging the way it's starting out. So there is still interest in that story outside of Nova Scotia, where I think it's, although it's still selling here, people have told me here. I was contacted only last week by a filmmaker, a producer in New York, who read it and wanted to know if he could do a spec script for my approval before he went for financing, because I've turned down all offers to make it into a movie because I don't think it would be appropriate. I don't think the families need to see that, but he's writing up a spec script and my agent in New York wants to see it. So I don't know. It's kind of out of my hands now. I just let it go once I let Otto take it. It's playing in the big leagues in New York and I'm not there. So I don't know.
I'll end this episode with Fonz Jessam describing his next project. It's his first work of fiction, Disposable Souls. It's available now at nimbus.ca.
Disposable Souls is the title. It's the first in a crime fiction series based here in Halifax, based in large part on an outlaw motorcycle gang and one character who left the club, became a war hero and then a police officer, and then lands a case that kind of ties all those worlds together, and he's not quite sure where he fits. Mm-hmm. And that's where the series begins. And that book will be launched at the Warfrat Rally in Digby, which is a large Nova Scotia's largest motorcycle rally, which is the appropriate place to launch what I hope will become biker fiction in Nova Scotia. I finished my journalism career earlier than expected, although 35 years is hardly early, because of severe CPTSD. I was diagnosed years ago and continued to work, but I've been told by my doctors to stay away from true crime and journalism, and so the type of journalism I plan to do in the future is crime fiction, which really is a beautiful form of journalism because it uncovers the rocks and looks under them. And if you read this book, you'll see that what you're reading about Halifax is the Halifax that I saw for, you know, the 20 years that I reported here covering crime scenes. And I believe the best crime fiction is social commentary at the very least. But it's a form of journalism. It's showing people what's real. And that's the type of crime fiction I intend to write because it's really all I know how to do.
With that, we have completed part 3 of this series covering the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. As the story has now been told from the beginning up to the present day, any additional entries in this series will be to cover current events or feature interviews with those touched by this tragedy. Having said that, I'd like to invite anyone close to this crime that's interested in sharing their story to contact me at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. Regardless of which side of the courtroom you sat on, be it family, friends, co-workers, or even Darren Muse, I invite you to speak with me privately or publicly. I would again like to thank Fonz Jessam for appearing in this episode. Mr. Jessam, I've learned a lot from you. It's truly an honor to have met you and a privilege to collaborate with you in this way. To the families affected by this senseless crime, I hope the Nighttime Podcast's telling of this event was respectful, accurate, and tasteful. I can't begin to imagine your pain, and I only wish you the best in your healing. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 per month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current patrons and welcome the newest members to the group, Leslie, Martin, Griffin, Dale, Paul, and Greg. Without you, the production of the show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. To stay up to date with the show, please follow me at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast and on Twitter, where my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or feedback for the show, I always enjoy hearing from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.